Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Episode 18, Dispatches from the Electronic Frontier.
This Week in Law is brought to you by Audible. For your free audiobook, visit audiblepodcast.com/TWiL. And by GoToMeeting. For a month of unlimited online meetings, absolutely free, go to GoToMeeting.com/TWiL. We'd like to thank Victor Cajau for help with this podcast. You can listen to Victor's own podcast, The Typical Mac User, at TypicalMacUser.com.
Hi, this is Denise Howell, and you're back with us here on This Week in Law. We've got a great show for you this time around. Our special guest is EFF's Fred Von Lohmann, senior intellectual property lawyer there. Thanks so much for joining us this week, Fred.
Thank you.
And we've got some of our regular and irregular panelists joining us once again. We have Colette Vogel of VogelLaw.com. Thanks for coming back, Colette.
It's great to be here, Denise. Thank you.
Also with us is Carl Sussman of Sussman Insurance. Carl is not a lawyer, but writes, or doesn't actually write them, but sets
people. Do I play one on TV?
Yeah, exactly. Sets people up with insurance for their online communications related activities. And it's great to have you back with us, Carl.
Thank you. Am I a regular or am I irregular? I was waiting for you to decide that.
I'm going to let the listeners decide, but in my heart of hearts, you're all quite irregular.
Okay.
And also we've got with us internet lawyer Evan Brown from internetcases.com. Thanks so much for coming back, Evan.
Hi, Denise. Thanks for having me.
So we've got a bunch of stuff to discuss today. And one thing fresh off the presses that Fred already has a post up about, which echoed exactly what I had in my mind as I read the bullet point on it, is that the McCain campaign has gone ahead and sent via its general counsel a letter to YouTube's general counsel about its DMCA takedown practices. Now, I'm real curious to hear the backstory on this, which I'm hoping one of you knows. But the gist of the letter is to YouTube, hey, political speech is a wonderful thing, and you're a great platform for that, and this whole DMCA process that keeps taking down our videos is really getting in our way. And we believe that political speech is one of the most important kinds of speech that's protected on YouTube, and that our campaign and any candidate's campaign should get special treatment in the way that you're responding to takedown notices. So we don't know what YouTube thinks about all that, but you can read a copy of the letter on Fred's blog or on Lawrence Lessig's blog, too. That's where I first saw this, thanks to Colette, who emailed us last evening. Does anybody know how this got public? Did YouTube go ahead and put this out, or was it publicly available on the McCain site, or was this somehow leaked?
This is Fred again. I know that the McCain folks sent copies of the letter to a number of other people. I got one directly from them yesterday evening myself. So I think they sent this out more as a public letter than just as a communication straight to YouTube. So I assume that's where Larry Lessig got a copy as well, and I imagine many others received copies as well.
Fred, why don't you give us your reaction to this letter as you wrote it up on Deep Links?
Well, obviously we are, very much in step with the McCain campaign in terms of saying that political speech matters a great deal. It's the First Amendment protects it, and that sites like YouTube offer a great new outlet for that kind of speech. We, of course, have been talking about the problem of these bogus DMCA takedowns. These are notices sent to sites like YouTube claiming that there is copyright infringement when in fact there is not. And in the case of the McCain letter, they point out that many of their videos include short snippets from news broadcasts. And apparently that seems to be what has been causing these takedowns, presumably from the major news networks, ABC, CBS, NBC, folks like that. So we agreed that this is a big problem. The McCain campaign, though, has a proposed solution that we're not as enthusiastic about. And their solution is just that all candidates and campaigns that have YouTube accounts should be given special treatment, namely that YouTube should assign legal staff to review notices that are takedown notices that are sent to those particular accounts. Of course, that's great as far as it goes, but it doesn't provide any protection for the millions of other YouTubers who are not professionals, part of a political campaign, who are also doing political speech. So we think the solution doesn't go nearly far enough.
Right. And it was funny how the letter went ahead and prefaced that suggestion with the notion that we know you don't have time to carefully review each and every DMCA notice that comes in the door and consider all of the ramifications of compliance. But we think you should make an exception for us and for political campaigns. And that doesn't quite cut the mustard, does it?
Well, I certainly don't think it does. I do think YouTube could be doing a little more, and we're thinking about some possibilities that would protect the free speech interests of everyone on YouTube. And one thing we think is that counter notices, in other words, when a takedown notice is sent for a video, the user who posted it is entitled under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to send a counter notice that will result in the video generally being restored, but only after a 10-day waiting period while everyone waits to see if the copyright owner will sue. And so in our view, one thing YouTube could do, and I think they have done in some cases in the past, is review those counter notices, and if it's obvious that the video is not infringing, to give up that 10-day waiting period and just put the video up right away. Another option that we think they probably should think about is once a counter notice has been sent from an account, it seems reasonable to have humans review every takedown notice that comes to that account from that point forward. So in other words, do something like what the McCain campaign is suggesting, but don't do it just for campaigns and candidates, but do it for anybody who is being, in essence, harassed offline, you know, off of YouTube by these takedown notices. So I think those two measures might make a big difference, and I don't think they would be too onerous for YouTube. Although I should, you know, obviously start by saying the real bad actors here are obviously the news networks who shouldn't be sending these notices in the first place.
Is that what the context of this is? Were the takedown notices coming from the major news networks and aimed at things on the campaign site?
That seems to be the case. The McCain letter yesterday did not specifically detail which of their videos were removed, but they did describe that the reason the videos were targeted for takedowns was because they included a few seconds, I think the letter says less than 10-second clips from news programming. Certainly, we've seen some examples that have gotten some publicity. There was an ad that the McCain campaign put up that included a clip from one of the Palin, Katie Couric videos, interview videos. We also know from press reports that Barack Obama has had at least one video removed thanks to a DMCA takedown from NBC because it included clips from NBC news programming.
Fred, this is Evan. Do you think this is at least a step in the right direction, though, on the part of the McCain campaign to suggest this, especially given how soon the election is? I mean, I'm not sure that we can read into this that they're proposing it to be a permanent solution, that YouTube should just, you know, from this point on, only give more scrutiny to complaints pertaining to you know, the accounts of political figures. So, I mean, can we at least say that it's a step in the right direction on the McCain campaign to do something kind of as an emergency measure, asking YouTube to take these measures between now and November 4th?
I agree. I think it's definitely a step in the right direction. But I think we need more, particularly because, you know, the election is coming up very quickly. As you point out, I think we've got roughly 20 days or so left. And to have a video be removed for a 10-day waiting period is obviously basically the whole game. And I do think that that lends a certain level of urgency here. But obviously, that's an urgency that's not limited just to the McCain campaign. or even both or all the campaigns that are out there, presidential, congressional, and otherwise, because I expect in the next 20 days there will be more, you know, individual amateur voter-generated video than all of those official campaigns combined. So I think YouTube really should start thinking about the steps it can put in place quickly to protect not just the McCain and Obama campaigns, but, you know, all of the user-generated content. Of course, as I mentioned a moment ago, the best thing that can happen here is for the news networks to back off and stop sending these takedowns. So perhaps there needs to be some follow-up attention aimed at ABC, CBS, CNN, all of the various networks, just to get their commitment that in the next 20 days they won't go after these kinds of political fair use videos.
I don't know about you all, but I found it really refreshing that this whole issue came up, and it found it even more pleasing that it was on McCain Palin letterhead, you know, raising an issue like this that really seems to, you got to give them credit for being pretty, you know, progressive in their thinking on this.
I absolutely agree with that. I'm very happy, as I said earlier, I'm very pleased to see a presidential candidate talk about the importance of fair use. We really haven't seen that lately.
You wonder how much John McCain and Sarah Palin individually know, you know, about this issue, or, you know, how much they've actually been briefed on it and are aware of the issues.
It should be added to the technology policy portion of their campaign site.
Well, yeah.
As an addendum.
If they want to get the most mileage out of the time that, you know, that they had Trevor Potter's people working on it, you know, because obviously they want to make this a political issue too, or they wouldn't have bothered to share it with, you know, among others, the EFF and others, you know, who are going to be putting it out there. It seems like that would be a great way to get the extra mileage out of that, make it part of the platform.
Well, that's actually, if I can jump in, just that's a question that I have, is how much of this do you think is really just a matter of trying to get attention in any way, shape, or form at this stage of the game? Because it was sent to so many different people other than just to YouTube. I mean, if you were to be truly interested in making change, do you think it's necessary to have this type of a letter go out to so many people versus just to the organization that would be making the changes?
I think it's very important to send the message out to the interested public. I don't have any cynical suspicion about this. To me, it looks pretty clear that the campaign is recognizing that as we come into the last 20 days or so of the campaign, these 10-day blackouts on YouTube are a serious problem for their messaging. These are, after all, their ads and their web videos. And they, of course, recognize that that's an incredibly important new mechanism to reach out to people. I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of controversy around some of the videos that they've been putting out, but that just goes to show that it's a very effective medium. So I have no reason to think that they're anything but sincere in wanting to get this problem fixed. And quite frankly, I expect the Obama campaign probably feels the same way.
Definitely is.
Go ahead.
I was just going to jump in and say, well, what about, you know, the problem, as Fred has noted, is really with the parties who are actually sending the notices. It's not YouTube or the fair users that are really the problem here. And, you know, I wonder if one or two good targeted 512F suits, you know, ready, teed up, and filed immediately would, you know, shut up the parties who are bringing these takedown notices and causing the problem in the first place. I don't know if that's jumping to litigation may not be the right strategy here, but it would certainly, you know, wake up the parties who are sending the notices, especially since the attorney's fees provisions are fairly generous.
And just for the benefit of our listeners, Colette, could you explain what that means, bringing a suit under 512F?
Yeah, so the DMCA offers an opportunity for a party who's been wrongfully targeted to bring a suit under Section 512F, which is arguing, you have to allege that the party who sent the notice did it in bad faith. I think that's the standard, or the part of the actual section. Fred, you can probably correct me on that, on the language of the section. But, you know, so if a party receives a DMCA takedown and there's really, it's completely baseless, you can then sue the company who, or the individual who brought the takedown in the first place, and get an order in your favor and ask for your attorney's fees.
Yeah, one thing here that's so troubling about this to me is that look at the people who would be able to sue, say, NBC or CBS for sending these takedowns. The law says that either the online service provider, in this case YouTube, they're entitled to sue. And, of course, the other person who's entitled to sue is the person whose videos were removed, in this case the campaigns. I agree with Colette that the straightforward way to punish someone who's misusing the process is through litigation using this provision of the law, which, you know, is a pretty good thing to have. But the problem here, of course, is YouTube doesn't want to sue these companies because they are simultaneously pursuing partnerships to feature their videos on YouTube. There was just an announcement last week about CBS putting full television programs on YouTube. And of course, the campaigns, I assume, are probably very reluctant to go after a network news enterprise on the eve of a national election where those same networks are going to be covering the campaigns. So we have kind of a bad alignment of incentives here that I think is very unfortunate, which is, again, why I think the McCain campaign sending this letter to lots of people may have been exactly the right thing to do, because hopefully that results in shaming some of these news networks, getting people talking about the fact that, you know, what on earth is NBC thinking? What on earth are CNN and CBS and whoever it is who is sending these notices, what on earth are they thinking trying to stifle this kind of political speech right on the eve of an election?
Right. It's an easy little point to insert in the argument of the bias of the mass media, or the prejudice of the mass media against the McCain campaign.
Yeah, although, again, as I said, Barack Obama's campaign has been targeted as well. So I think it's a short-sightedness that has more to do with the copyright views of some of these companies than it does with any partisanship.
From a different angle, when do you think we got to the point where YouTube was such a demanding power in an election? I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, yes, yes, yes. Wait a minute, YouTube. It wasn't that long ago when I would mention YouTube to somebody and they would say, what? What is that? I mean, when did we have this turning point where to be, you know, ousted from YouTube all of a sudden becomes, you know, a major issue in someone's, you know, potential presidential campaign?
Well, I think we reached that turning point a while ago. In fact, EFF and the ACLU put out a press release about 2 months ago, in which we said, hey, everybody, it should be obvious to us by now that YouTube and other user-generated content sites are going to be a focus for political expression in this campaign season. And so I think most folks who've been watching have known for some time, certainly since the campaign season really started ramping up, that this was very likely to happen. Now, of course, that isn't that long ago. Maybe a year ago, it should have started becoming obvious. But the thing, you know, from my perspective, I think that nobody can claim to have been surprised. I mean, all of the forces were aligned. You had an incredible amount of interest in YouTube, incredible number of people going there to watch things, all kinds of political expression showing up there. I'm reminded of the Will I Am video for Obama that was such a galvanizing media event for a lot of Obama supporters back, whatever that was, I think late last year. So this is stuff. And in fact, if we just go back to the last presidential election, how many people remember the This Land parody that was done?
Jib Jab.
We can't by Jib Jab. Jib Jab.
Can't
yeah.
Believe
so,
it's been that long.
So, you know, the video, you know, homegrown video was poised to make a big impact. And I think this is just what most of us were expecting.
Yeah, it seems to be a natural extension of the way things have gone since, you know, 2003 or so, you know, leading up to the 04 election and kind of the building of a grassroots approach. This kind of stuff's on my mind because just this past week at my firm, Howard Dean came in and spoke. It was a little, you know, breakfast fundraiser event for, you know, one of the local candidates running for the state's attorney. And, you know, it was mainly a political talk that he gave, you know, for 20 minutes. But he did give a mention of this grassroots effort that was coming up from, you know, from the bottom up in 2003, folks were using Meetup kind of on their own to get together and talk about the Dean campaign. And he talked about how his campaign, their real effort was to just get out in front of that and leverage it, not necessarily, you know, be the originators of it, but to use that. And so if you think of it in terms of a wave that began, or some kind of energy that was begun then and has just kind of curved upward, and the graph being increased use of social media for political communications and discourse, you know, it's just kind of that arc has extended upward, and here we are in 2008, and these are the issues that present themselves.
So, Fred, do you think there's a logical next step here as far as giving YouTube some kind of proposal that actually makes sense for more users than simply political campaigns, and working with them along those lines?
I think so. We're thinking about it today, trying to figure out what a proposal might look like that would make sense from YouTube's point of view. Obviously, as the McCain-Palin letter points out itself, no one imagines that YouTube can or should have to review every video when it's posted. That obviously would be more work than any number of staffers could possibly undertake. But there must be some way to inject human review here to protect the uses that are obviously non-infringing. I mean, we're not asking YouTube or the copyright owners to try to decide the hard cases kind of on the edge of fair use law, but rather the things that are really straightforward, like using a 5-second clip from a news report in order to comment on the report itself or make a point in the course of a commentary video. Things like that, I think you don't need to be a lawyer to figure out that that's probably not within the scope of copyright.
You think someone like Viacom would agree with you on that point?
Well, that's, I think, the next question. I think that this question should be taken not just to YouTube, but also to the companies that run these news organizations, the companies that are actually sending the notices. So I just echo what Colette said earlier, that they are the problem in this case. They are the ones who are sending these takedowns. And I think, you know, somebody should, put the camera on them and say, is this really what you intend? Do you really have a problem with a 5-second clip in a McCain commercial or a 8-second clip in an Obama ad? Is that what copyright is for in your eyes? I would love to have them be required to answer those kinds of questions in a public forum. I think maybe that is the best next step, is to sort of take the letter that was sent by the McCain-Palin campaign and go back to the people who were sending the takedown notices and say, what's up?
I tell you what's going to happen next, and that is the McCain-Palin campaign is going to adopt the Prince song "Let's Go Crazy" as an anthem.
You know, this also reminds me of months ago during the primaries. There was debate about what could happen with the video footage from the debates, and if I recall correctly, the studios or the networks, I should say, who were going to be given the right to produce and air the debates came to some open agreement about the reuse of that content, you know, on blogs and on the internet. And it was quite a challenging debate. And Denise, we may have even talked about it on one of the earlier episodes of this program, because I know it was in the blogosphere a bit during the primaries. So I wonder if there could be some sort of consensus or, you know, best practice or, you know, agreement among the networks on these things when it has to do with political speech as clear as this.
Yeah, I think you're right. We did address that a while ago, and I think it was C-SPAN, was it not, that was putting up big roadblocks with respect to its debate coverage.
This is
an area where Carl Malamud at publicresource.org also did a lot of work to try to get all the campaigns to essentially say they have no objection to those kinds of reuses of debate footage. And of course, Carl also was the champion last year in getting C-SPAN to make all of its floor coverage and committee coverage of Congress available under a Creative Commons license. And so those are all great steps. Of course, nobody is asserting that the, you know, Katie Couric, Sarah Palin interviews should be public domain or anything like that. So I think, you know, while things like the debates and the floor footage and speeches might be something we could get them to let go of, when it comes to the actual newscasts and other things like that, I think we really need to focus on the fair use question and allowing people, campaigns as well as individuals, to take short clips in the course of commentary and criticism.
Before we go any further, I want to encourage everyone to get on over to gotomeeting.com/twill, T-W-I-L, and sign up for the 30-day free trial of the GoToMeeting service that's waiting for you there. GoToMeeting lets you have your meetings online instead of in person, saving you money, time, and travel. GoToMeeting is there for you the next time you're ready to book a plane ticket and fly halfway around the world to have a meeting. Use your free trial instead. Set up a GoToMeeting session and see how you can have multiple users from multiple locations in the same meeting at the same time without ever leaving your office. You can use it for sales presentations, product demos, training, or collaboration on documents or projects. It's easy. It takes just a couple of minutes to set up. It's secure. And once your 30-day free trial is over, one low, flat monthly rate gets you unlimited use of the service. Go over to gotomeeting.com/twill. Give the service a try. Fred, do you have any good handle on what the volume is comparatively of the counter notices that come into YouTube? I've got to think it's a very small percentage of all the takedown notices they get.
Yeah, that's our impression as well. They have not quantified that for us, but I can't believe that the counter notices account for more than, you know, if it was more than 10 or 20 a month, I would be surprised. It's just not, our experience has been, it's not that common. Users often don't know how to make use of the procedure. Many users are in fact intimidated by the procedure because, you know, to send a counter notice to somebody like NBC or CBS or somebody like that is in essence to volunteer to withstand a lawsuit if they disagree with you.
Right.
And so, you know, when if you have EFF signed up to represent you for free, then that's something you might be willing to do. But if you don't, it can be quite intimidating to have to cross that that Rubicon. So my sense is YouTube is looking at a small number of counter notices, which is exactly why I think that human review is something that should be feasible. And then those accounts should be marked for further human review, it seems to me, because, you know, if you've been targeted for a counter notice, if you've been targeted for a takedown and have been willing to stand up for your First Amendment rights by sending a counter notice, including a willingness to be sued, essentially to go to court over your right to post that video, it seems to me we'll be talking about a relatively small number of accounts and exactly the ones that deserve some protection.
So let's talk about some of the other things the EFF is up to these days, which frankly, I don't even know how you were able to spare an hour of your time today to join us because you guys are so busy and we really do appreciate your doing it. I know you're jetting off to DC later this week, so we're just thrilled to have the chance to chat with you. Let's talk about EFF's involvement in the LimeWire case and what's going on there. Could you bring us up to speed?
Sure. LimeWire remains one of the most popular peer-to-peer file-sharing applications out there today, having supplanted Kazaa to some extent and sort of taken the crown. They've been in litigation with the recording industry now for, I think, going on 3 years, and the case has finally come around to a summary judgment motion, which which is an opportunity for both sides to basically say, we don't need to go to trial. The evidence is clear. One side or the other side gets to win without the need for any further proceedings. So both sides have moved for summary judgment. Both sides are confident in their entitlement to victory at this stage. We intervened or filed an amicus brief, I should say, on behalf of a number of different groups. We were only one of a large number of public interest and industry groups, all of whom in the brief said that whatever you do here, Judge, don't jeopardize the Betamax doctrine, which is the doctrine that allows companies to make products, even though those products can be used for infringement, so long as those products are capable of substantial non-infringing uses. So in other words, the message was, don't do anything here that would make it impossible for Apple to continue making iPods, or Xerox to continue making photocopiers, or you know, Intel to continue making the chips that power our personal computers. And so that was sort of the message. The brief was filed on behalf of neither party. The brief did not express a view about who should win that particular case, but just wanted to caution the judge. And quite frankly, it was critical of many of the arguments that the recording industry plaintiffs were making, to the extent those arguments would potentially erode the Betamax doctrine, the foundation of a lot of the products we take for granted.
That was essentially the crux of the amicus brief EFF filed in the Grokster case, wasn't it?
Well, in Grokster, we were lawyers
on behalf of the
defendants. So that in that one, it was our brief on behalf of our client. But yes, the themes were very similar. In the Grokster case, which was decided by the Supreme Court in 2005, the court ducked a lot of those questions and said instead that if you advertise or encourage or induce people to use your product for copyright infringement, that you would be held responsible if, in fact, they went ahead and accepted your invitation and committed copyright infringement with your product. While that seems like a perfectly sensible thing to say, and you know, obviously most companies go out of their way never to do something like that, it didn't answer the underlying questions, which were, you know, what if you didn't induce, but nevertheless people out there use your products to infringe? And it also left a lot of questions open about what constitutes inducement. And so those are some of the themes that were sort of left unfinished by the Supreme Court in 2005 that the court in New York in the LimeWire case is going to have to pick up now. So that's why we thought, and as I said, the other groups, including the Consumer Electronics Association and a number of others, said, you know, we need to make sure the judge doesn't go off track here, particularly with the recording industry urging a very expansive notion of this inducement approach.
Fred, this is Colette. What do you know much about this particular judge, and if the judge has made other rulings in copyright cases that can give us any indication of the judge's views?
I don't know very much. He's certainly, you know, not a judge who's, famous in copyright cases, or at least whose name I've encountered before. But, you know, by all accounts, a judge that's a thoughtful judge, and, you know, we'll see, you know, this may be our first opportunity to see, you know, what the judge thinks about a major copyright case. The thing to remind all of your listeners is, copyright takes an awful lot of our time thinking about these subjects every day, but for the typical federal judge, copyright is a very rare bird. Many judges will see only one or two copyright cases in their entire careers on the bench. And even in a court like New York or Los Angeles that sees more than their fair share, I think it's fair to say there are very few judges who would call themselves copyright experts. So it's really important that the judge get full and thorough briefing to understand, you know, what the issues are, and that was part of the reason we thought it was important to file a brief here, because you know, there are, you know, any decision the judge makes here is likely to linger and affect future cases for many years. And obviously, the Sony Betamax case itself, decided by the Supreme Court in 1984, the importance of the case, of the precedent, long outlasted the technology in question. You know, Betamax is now ancient history, but the case is still cited by copyright lawyers all the time.
Which is a good segue into a concern that I have on this. This is Evan. I mean, it's a different world now technologically. You know, the world of LimeWire is very different than the world of, you know, just being you know, concerned about VCRs. And so, I mean, just to be take the position of the devil's advocate here, can we say with a straight face that LimeWire is really capable, or even merely capable, of a substantial non-infringing use when we know how it really is used? I mean, is it even plausible to say that?
Oh, I think it's very plausible. I think the two things are actually somewhat unrelated. I think it's quite clear that technologies like LimeWire and BitTorrent and all of the other file sharing technologies that are out there are capable of non-infringing use. In fact, we know that for a fact because there are more and more companies that are using those networks to distribute authorized content, whether it be, you know, demos for video games or, you know, other promotional material. Folks have used those file sharing networks to distribute little advertisements and music videos for up and coming bands, you know, all manner of stuff out there. Not to mention, of course, all the authorized sharing of, you know, non-commercial things like, you know, Grateful Dead recordings, Fish recordings, all of the kind of the taper community has long said it's fine to trade audience tapes on, you know, in any medium you like, and the bands have signed off on that, and so there's no problem there. So, you know, there's plenty of non-infringing uses out there. Now, that being said, I think you're right when you say that it's nowhere near a majority, that's for sure. There is plenty of copyright infringement going on out there, too. But I just want to remind people that's not so unusual when it comes to the history of technology. If you look back at the early days of the VCR, remember when the Betamax was introduced, there were no Blockbuster video rental stores. In fact, for many years, the movie studios refused to put any movies out on videotape. And it's hard to imagine that today, given the ubiquity of Netflix and Blockbuster and all of the rentals of VHS cassettes that we all grew up with. But that's not how it started. And of course, in those first few years, if you actually looked at what people were using their VCR for, many of them were doing things that, you know, the studios would say was obviously infringing. In fact, there was a magazine that was introduced as evidence in the trial in 1979. And that magazine included a classified section, which was basically like Napster on paper, right? The subscribers would say, I've got a copy of these movies. I'm looking for those movies. We should get together, dub some tapes, and exchange them in the mail. So, you know, this is not a new phenomenon. What ends up making these technologies work out in the long run is business models being adjusted. You know, the studios had a big problem when they refused to put any movies out on videotape. But once they turned that corner and started to put movies out for rental, they, of course, transformed the Betamax from a threat into an opportunity. And I see no reason why peer-to-peer networks won't take that same path.
Right. I agree with you on most points on this whole issue, really, but in particular that, you know, the business models are going to change. And certainly there has been a drastic change since 2002, 2003 when it comes to this. But there really are two issues that give me, you know, pause on hanging our hat on this being capable of or merely being capable of a substantial non-infringing use. And the first one is, you know, what I was expressing earlier. Can we stand up and say with a straight face that LimeWire is in reality used for a substantial non-infringing use? And I know that I'm mischaracterizing what the standard is, kind of like maybe what the plaintiffs are doing in the Ericsson Records case. But the other thing that gives me a little bit of pause here and makes me think that it's perhaps not real strong footing to be talking about the capable of substantial non-infringing use standard is the fact that in the Betamax case, fair use played such a more prominent role. And the whole method of the VCR was validated perhaps to a greater extent than what peer-to-peer technology has been because, you know, of course, we all know like the back of our hands that it's okay to make a copy of an audio visual work for purposes of time shifting and like that. So, and we have case law that says the exact opposite when it comes to trading music files over the internet. So that's, however that whole 800 pound gorilla of fair use plays into this, it seems like not quite as a strong support for that substantial non-infringing use point.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that is you go back to the Sony Betamax ruling from 1984 from the Supreme Court, it turns out the court, in deciding whether the Betamax had substantial non-infringing uses, identified two different non-infringing uses, each of which, or I should say either of which, the court emphasized would have been enough. So one is the fair use for time shifting that you mentioned, and obviously that was something that also got a lot of attention at the time and continues to be an important ruling, that time shifting for watching later was viewed as a fair use. You did not need the copyright owner's permission for that. But the other use was for authorized recording, for shows where the copyright owner actually was happy to have people record it.
And this is where Mr. Rogers comes in, right?
Exactly. The most famous witness in that case was Mr. Rogers, who testified that he actually was very happy to have parents record his program and so that they could watch it with their children after work. And so in that particular use case, amounted to no more than 9% of all the uses of the Betamax VCR. Only 9% were using it for that purpose. And the court specifically said that that alone was enough to be a substantial non-infringing use. And that was a theme that, in fact, Justice Breyer, in his concurrence in the Grokster case in 2005, also underscored. That 9% in the view of the court is enough to be a substantial non-infringing use, in large part because what's 9% today could grow to be 20 or 30 or 70% several years down the road. There's no way for us to know in advance. So that's why merely capable of substantial non-infringing uses is so important, and why, in fact, in our amicus brief, joined by the likes of the Consumer Electronics Association and a number of telecom industry groups and public interest groups, we all agreed that that is the standard, and that's the standard that it's both the right standard and also the one that the court adopted all the way back in 1984. So, you know, there are, don't get me wrong, there are certainly some concerns here. You know, obviously you shouldn't be allowed to affirmatively endorse or induce people to commit copyright infringement. We have no fundamental objection to that. And similarly, you have a situation where, you know, if in fact you are clearly involved directly with the infringing activity, there's some cases out there where people basically get together and conspire with infringers to supply them with raw materials, things like that. You know, there's no problem with infringement in those contexts. But here, you know, again, we're not taking a position on whether LimeWire should win or lose in the case right now. But it's worth remembering, this is a company that makes a piece of software. The software is distributed to users. LimeWire has no way of knowing or controlling what people do with that software, any more than Xerox does when it sells a photocopier, or than Microsoft does when it distributes Internet Explorer. Obviously, both of those technologies are used for copyright infringement in the hands of end users all the time. Another product I like to point to is DVD and CD burners. I think if you went and you actually figured out how much of the use of burners is for infringing versus non-infringing use, you might also see a situation where there's a lot of infringement, but no one thinks that, certainly I hope no one thinks that, you know, Sony and Philips and Matsushita and every company that makes a CD burner should be on the hook for every one of those acts. So again, the goal is to come up with a balanced a test that preserves room for innovation, and you know, we think the Betamax test got that right, and that's going to be part of what the court in New York has to wrestle with in this LimeWire case. We probably won't get a ruling until sometime in the spring.
Fred, is the merely capable standard directly under fire in the LimeWire case? Are you is your brief responding directly to arguments that have been made there?
Yes, in fact, the recording industry has returned with some of the same arguments they had been making in the Grokster case years before. Perhaps echoing some of the conversations we've just been having, they say that the test should be based on what the actual uses are, the proportion of non-infringing versus infringing uses. They emphasize that, a test that was specifically rejected in the Betamax case. They also argue that the non-infringing uses by themselves must be enough to sustain the business of the defendant, sort of claiming that, you know, if LimeWire was forced to make all of its money from only non-infringing users, they would be out of business, and that should be the test. Again, we don't think that's the right test, and I don't think Sony would have survived under that test in the, you know, late 70s because, you know, as I said earlier, there were no authorized movies on videotape at the time. So the Betamax test is under attack in that case. There's also some important questions about the scope of inducement liability that have come up. As I mentioned earlier, if the Supreme Court in 2005 made it clear you're not allowed to induce or encourage people to use your technology for infringement, and they specifically said, you know, if you have the intent to cause infringement combined with communications or, you know, other affirmative acts encouraging people to infringe, that you can be responsible for those infringements. And here in the LimeWire case, the recording industry is really pushing for a intent alone standard. In other words, in their view, if you had bad thoughts in your heart and you distributed a piece of technology, whether it's a photocopier or a peer-to-peer software or an operating system, that you should be liable as an inducer just because, you know, you had bad intent, even if you never told anyone about it. And that strikes us as a real dangerous direction to go, because obviously it opens the door to an endless number of depositions and document discovery to try to find out if any engineer in the company ever had a bad thought about what the technology might be used for. And, you know, that's an incredibly expensive road to send a technology company down. And in our view, would really encourage frivolous litigation that doesn't really help anyone.
That's essentially what happened in the Grokster case, isn't it? Didn't they comb through until they found smoking guns and then paraded them before the court?
Yeah, that's certainly a part of it. They reviewed years of documents going back all the way to the beginning of the companies, and they pointed to things like marketing plans that were never implemented and advertising programs that were never put out in the field. And they said, aha, we found the evidence of your bad intent. And of course, you know, from our perspective, if some advertising exec came up with a campaign that encouraged infringement and you killed the campaign, you said, don't go out with that campaign, seems to me to be the opposite of inducement. But nevertheless, that's what's at stake here. And our argument on that is that you have to have some affirmative act that communicates to users that they should infringe. And so if you just have bad intent in your heart, but you don't ever tell your users about it, it shouldn't count. That seems like a test that will cut off wasteful lawyering, because it means the lawyers have to actually find some smoking gun that was sent out to the world. And if they can't find that smoking gun, they don't get to go dumpster diving through the entire, you know, corporate history looking for any hint that someone had bad intent toward copyright owners.
Fred, this is Evan. Do you have any knowledge? I know that, you know, in the brief, it talked about how a lot of the evidence in the record had been filed under seal. And so I was wondering if you have any knowledge or information that you're at liberty to talk about. I don't know if you would have ever become party to an agreement under the protective order or whatever. Do you have any knowledge as to what the evidence is that the plaintiffs have in terms of this inducement? You know, what LimeWire did. And if you'll indulge me, I'll just read from paragraph 48 of the amended complaint. This seems pretty weak to me. It says, LimeWire in particular has been designed and promoted for its superior infringement capabilities. You know, I read that and thought, ah, here we go. But then, and then they go on to say, for example, defendants state that, quote, and you tell me if you see anything bad about this, the purchase of LimeWire Pro gives users better search results, turbocharged download speeds, connections to more sources, and a guarantee of no ads or nagware. Now, when I read that, that makes me think that they're just trying to work with some pretty bad facts and turn something that's something that is not something into something that they want it to be. Going back to my question, do you know of what the real evidence is in the record in the LimeWire case as to this inducement activity?
I don't have all that evidence. As we mentioned in the brief, much of that is filed under seal. It's a trade secret for the companies that are involved in this litigation. And so we, as outsiders, as I said earlier, we filed an amicus brief. We're not directly involved as lawyers in the case. We don't have the full set of facts. But I agree with you that when reading the publicly filed documents, which are, you know, redacted in places, but when reading the publicly filed documents, you definitely get the sense that what the recording industry objects to here, what they claim as evidence of inducement is really things like, oh, they built a piece of software that was really good for music.
Right.
You know, one of the facts they point out is they put a music player in the software. And that shows evidence that they really meant to cause lots and lots of infringement.
Right. Heaven forbid it actually work well.
Right, exactly. And so that, to me, does not encourage anyone to commit copyright infringement. That is just trying to build a product that has more features that are useful for lots of different things. And the same is true for, you know, turbocharged search results and, you know, all of these enhancements to the product, none of which, you know, have a big flashing light that says, you know, use this to download U2 track. Mm-hmm. What I've seen is not very conclusive. I will note that LimeWire itself is not saying that it should get to win at this stage on the inducement claim. All it's saying is there's evidence on both sides and we should get to put this in front of a jury. And that seems like a sensible point of view, particularly when you're arguing about what the intent of the designers and the executives might have been. That's a subject on which, you know, reasonable minds can differ. Obviously, they're going to say now that it was never their intention to commit copyright infringement, to encourage copyright infringement. And the plaintiffs are probably going to find isolated statements made in emails. I mean, Lord knows, with an infinite number of email, you can usually find something to suggest whatever you want. So that seems to me to be a classic example of the kind of issue that gets resolved at trial. So that may be ultimately where this case goes. And you know, if that's the case, then we probably won't get a final answer for some time.
You would really think that if the plaintiffs have evidence of that the defendants induced, you know, the users to commit liability, you'd be able to find, someone would be able to find it somewhere in the record, not under seal. I can't see why that would.
Or you'd see the redacted section would be right in the middle, kind of where you would imagine, here's the highlight, and it's all blacked out.
Or they would have
accidentally. We don't have that.
Or they would have accidentally, redacted it by using Word to just, you know, ink over it in black so that you can trace your cursor over it.
Right. The lawyers are getting too clever to fall for that particular oversight.
Hey, Fred, has there been any effort in this case on Arista's part to sort of say, okay, well, this peer-to-peer world has evolved over the last several years and has come to a point where it has good neighborhoods and bad neighborhoods. And if you're going to be doing legitimate things, you go to places like the Internet Archive. And if you're going to be engaging in copyright infringement, you're going to places like LimeWire. Is that theme coming out in the case at all?
There is a little bit of that. Not quite. I think maybe they should bring you on board. You've done a better job articulating it right there than I think they have in the papers. But what you do see in the recording industry's papers is basically a claim that no one would use P2P for these non-infringing uses because there's easier, faster, simpler ways to get the same stuff. So they'll say, well, nobody would download that Phish concert using LimeWire because they could just get it from the Internet Archive's online music archive.
Mm-hmm.
Things of that kind. But of course, that misses the point that there are, you know, the people are on LimeWire. That's why so many rights holders are trying to get their content up on that network, because that's where the people are.
Right.
And as long as that's the case, that's going to be a powerful engine for more non-infringing uses in the future. That after all, it was the success of the Betamax VCR that ultimately pushed the content owners to make their movies available on cassettes. So I think saying that, you could always go find the non-infringing stuff somewhere else sort of misses the point that it's the popularity of P2P networks for infringing uses, sure, that is part of what is driving a lot of non-infringing uses to get on those same networks to try to get in front of those same eyeballs. And I think that's, you know, that's a good thing. Over time, we should expect more and more non-infringing uses to sort of grab hold on these networks and hopefully, you know, change the balance. We at EFF have been saying for years now, one way to convert huge amount of the infringing activity overnight into non-infringing activity would be for the recording industry to offer users a way to basically pay for the P2P file sharing that they're going to do anyway. And we favor kind of a blanket license model that's described on our website. We've got a white paper called A Better Way Forward that describes it in detail. But the basic idea is let the music fans pay a few dollars a month in exchange for the freedom to download from wherever they like, peer-to-peer, you know, directly between each other, IM, whatever works for you. The record companies shouldn't care as long as they're getting paid. And if they were to take a step in that direction, then we would imagine that the non-infringing uses of these networks would immediately become the dominant use, because what people are up to would become licensed. And so there's an easy way to make a big shift happen, get rights holders paid, and take some of the pressure off of these court cases.
So let's talk real quickly about a point you raised a moment ago, which was that much infringement happens simply through your CD or DVD burner, and talk for a second about the Real DVD case and what's going on there. And this is fairly new. EFF is not directly involved, correct?
That's correct.
So once again, you guys might get involved down the road. This is still at the trial stage, so...
That's right. In fact, it's, you know, I think it was just filed about a week ago.
Right.
The movie industry and Real Networks basically filed dueling lawsuits. Real Networks filing here in San Francisco, the movie studios filing in Los Angeles, over Real's new Real DVD software, which is one of the first licensed pieces of software, as opposed to the many unauthorized pieces that we're all familiar with that rips DVDs. This one rips the DVD, you know, makes a digital copy of the DVD, puts it on a hard drive, allows you to watch it, you know, on a laptop or on a PC. This is something the movie studios have always hated. They continue to argue that no one is allowed lawfully to make any copies of a DVD for any purpose. They've decided to come after Real. Real, of course, is saying, hey, we got a license. We took a license from DVD CCA, which controls the encryption keys to DVDs. And they are following in the wake of a technology called Kaleidoscape, which had a similar lawsuit fight with Hollywood about a year and a half ago, and so far, at least, has been victorious. So I think Real was probably emboldened by Kaleidoscape's victory, decided to launch this new product, and now finds themselves locked in a courtroom battle over it.
So there's an injunction in the case that prevents Real DVD from selling its software for the immediate time being. Is that right?
That's right. The studios... The Los Angeles case got transferred up to San Francisco, where the studios rushed into court to ask for an injunction to bar continued distribution of Real DVD. Real managed to distribute about 3,000 copies before the court dropped the boom on them and said, yes, we're going to grant an injunction at least until we can hold further hearings, which are expected sometime in late November or early December. So that's definitely quite a blow to Real, which obviously it hoped, no doubt, to take advantage of the Christmas season for this product. It's just the opening round, and we'll get a better sense of where the judge is on this case and what Real's what their odds of victory might be after the hearing in late November, early December.
If I can ask just sort of a layman's question in this particular discussion, how is it that a company can purchase, which I assume Real had to do, a license to do what they're doing, and then having obtained that license and effectively the right to do what their product is designed to do, still have this hurdle to go through, and if they even make it through?
And that's a great question. It turns out there is a whole bunch of dispute about what the license actually permits. This is the same license that is used by lots of companies, including, you know, Apple and Microsoft and, you know, a whole bunch of companies that make DVD players, software-based DVD players. The big open question is, are you allowed under the license to make a permanent copy of the DVD on a local hard drive in order to, you know, facilitate playback later? And it turns out, at least I haven't seen the license because parts of it are under an NDA, but the people who've seen it appear to say that there is an open question about whether or not that's allowed. And this is what Kaleidoscape kind of spotted this issue a few years ago, built its own hardware-based product, ended up getting dragged into court, and the court, this was a California state court, after reading the license, basically said, yeah, there's nothing in the license that specifically forbids you from making a copy of this kind. It appears to have been either an oversight on the part of the drafters or maybe it was intentional. We don't really know. This is a document that was the product of lots of negotiation among dozens of companies that took place over several years. So it's a highly, highly negotiated document. Now, a lot of people have said, well, why don't they just amend the document if everybody agrees the contract should have forbidden copying? Why don't they just get together and, you know, amend the contract to do that? Well, it turns out the Hollywood studios have now tried twice to do that, but have been blocked by the technology companies that are members of this DVD CCA consortium. It turns out there's just a lot of disagreement in this group that is comprised of technology companies and Hollywood studios. Nobody quite can agree whether the license should permit this or not. And so that's how it is that Real Networks takes a license and yet nevertheless gets sued, because some people believe the license forbids copying, namely the studios. Other people read the very same license and say, hey, there's nothing in here that says we're not allowed to make a copy.
So that's one, Carl, where the insurance carrier might ask, hey, do you have a license to do what you're doing? And the company could legitimately answer, yes, we do, but they could still get sued.
Right.
And then turn to the insurer to please cover the cost.
Yeah.
Right.
In Real's case, I assume they can afford it, but it's definitely, there are a number of smaller companies that make similar products, mostly on the hardware side, sort of home video jukeboxes similar to the Kaleidoscape product. There are probably three or four other companies in that market as well, and I'm sure all of them are reading their insurance coverage carefully.
And Real DVD is more aimed toward time and place shifting, is it not?
Yeah, that's if you look at their online FAQs, they describe this as really a way to make a copy to watch on a laptop when you're, you know, going out of town, you have a long flight, you don't want to take the DVD and run down your battery. You can instead make a copy on the hard drive and, you know, you'll get the full 2 hours before your battery dries up, that kind of thing.
I take it 321 Studios did not have such a similar license.
Well, that's right. 321 Studios is a company, some of your listeners may remember their most famous product, DVD XCopy. And that was software that was really intended to allow you to make backup copies of your DVDs. So it was really optimized to allow you to burn a copy of a movie onto a blank DVD-R. And they got sued some years ago and lost, and they did not have a license. And their argument was simply that the Copyright Act and the DMCA leaves room for that kind of activity. And the court did not agree with them. And the big difference here, just so your listeners understand, the big divide is whether or not the content has DRM, digital rights management, or the language of the Copyright Act, a technical protection measure on it. So DVDs come encrypted, and that is the basis of Hollywood's argument that anybody who decrypts a DVD without a license, without permission, is automatically breaking the law, no matter what they ultimately want to use the footage for, whether, you know, to make a personal use copy or a fair use clip. It doesn't matter to Hollywood, in their view. Anybody who decrypts without a license is on the hook. In contrast, if you have a compact disc, for example, that compact disc has no encryption built into it, no other protection mechanism. And so there, we don't have the same decrypting without a license problem. And that's why you can make copies for your iPod, and, you know, Apple can put out iTunes and nobody has to get a license for that. And I think it's fair to say if Apple had to try to get a license for those functionalities, they probably would have had a hard time. So that we live today in a world where there are two different kinds of media products, some that are protected at birth, like DVDs and Blu-ray. And for those, Hollywood claims a much more restrictive set of laws that backed by the DMCA. And another set of media, like the compact disc and, you know, free over-the-air broadcast television, where the content is not encrypted, and we live in the old copyright world that we've all enjoyed for the last 40-odd years. So this is kind of the major shift today, and the Real DVD case really underscores how many fewer rights you have with media like DVDs that you buy than you used to have with things like compact discs and VHS cassettes.
And now for a few words about Audible.com, a fantastic site, not just because it's a sponsor of the show, for which we're very grateful, but because of its amazing and varied selection of audio works available for download and listening either at your computer or on the go on all manner of portable devices. Audible feels like a member of my family because it's with me whether I'm in the gym or in an airplane or just driving around in the car on long or short trips. It's on my iPhone, it's on my iPod, and my son is a huge fan as well. And what I like the most is when we can find things we can listen to together that we all enjoy. Right now we're listening to All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot, which is a book I remember fondly from my childhood reading with my parents. It's about a veterinarian and his practice in Yorkshire, England, and the first in a series of four such books. So I was a little bit wondering whether my four-year-old would be ready for this, but it's very family-friendly, and in fact, he really enjoys all of the details of the veterinary practice, including probably most especially the fact that the animals like to make all kinds of messes and throw their messes at the vets and farmers and things along the way in the stories. So the All Creatures Great and Small audio is available from Audible at $34.97 ordinarily, but as a listener to Twill, you can go to audiblepodcast.com/Twill and download this book for free when you sign up for Audible's free trial, which is explained there at that site. So thank you, Audible, and thank you, Twill listeners. Do check it out.
Well, Fred, we can't thank you enough for making sure that those fewer rights stay in place for all of us out here on the electronic frontier.
We can.
We're really happy that you joined us today on the show. Folks can catch up with you at EFF.org at the Deep Links blog, where you have many an insightful post on a regular basis. So thanks for that, too.
Great. Absolutely. And thank you guys for a great program. And hopefully our paths will cross soon.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun.
Wonderful. And thanks to all the rest of you for coming too. Evan, take care back there in Chicago. Folks can find you at internetcases.com.
That's right.
And yep. Internet Cases on Twitter. Fred, you're not on Twitter, are you?
Oh my gosh.
I'm not. Enough interrupt-driven modes of communication.
Couldn't find you on Twitter. Couldn't find you on Identica. Well, one of these days. And Colette is Colette on Twitter and Vogel Law on the web.
Thanks, Denise. It was great to be here.
Thank
you. It
was
always fun to hear Fred's thoughts on these issues. It was really interesting.
And Carl, thanks so much for joining us today. And folks can catch up with you at SussmanInsurance.com.
Thank you. Thank you.
And at CarlWireless.com, where you can find links to Carl's various blogs and podcasts and Twitter accounts and Facebook accounts, and all of which are too numerous to begin to list out. But thank you to Carl for joining us. And folks should also check out Carl's new organization podcast. Lord knows that if I were more organized, I would have already listened to it. So I'm going to have to make time and squeeze that into my life. What's it called again? And what's its URL?
It's at letstalkorganizing.com, and there's a blog and a podcast there as well.
Wonderful. All right, folks, take care.
Thank you.
Thanks, Denise.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.